Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion about the war on the poor, declared this week at a fiscal summit in New York, presided over by a billionaire deficit hawk who is championing the Ryan budget and promoting the belief that our fiscal woes are the result of too much spending on programs that help the middle class and the poor, and that these programs should be cut to reduce the deficit. Gary Rivlin, the co-director with Barbara Ehrenreich of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and author of Broke USA, joins us. Then we'll look into the just-released report by the U.S. Census Bureau that finds white births are a minority in America, with children from racial and ethnic minorities for the first time now accounting for more than half of the births in the United States. Mark Mather, a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau, joins us to discuss the divide between the older white population with the votes, money, and power, and a growing young population that is foreign to them. Then finally, Toby Miller joins us in the studio. He is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His latest book is Greening the Media, and we will discuss the dirty secrets that hide inside our favorite electronic devices, debunking the myth that information and communication technologies are clean and ecologically benign, while arguing for waves to make the media greener. And joining us now is Gary Rivlin, who's a journalist and author of five books, including Broke USA, and he's the co-editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, along with Barbara Ehrenreich. And early in his career, he covered Harold Washington's Chicago. Studs Terkel said of him he was to the Chicago political scene what I.F. Stone was to the national picture. And of course, Chicago is back in the news, front page story in the New York Times today, saying that a billionaire in Chicago who owns the Chicago Cubs is now financing a hit job against Obama, bringing up the Reverend Wright, etc. So the billionaires are loose in this country. And recently it was pointed out that in terms of the 99% versus the 1%, the actual figure is that this election is being bought by the 0.00063%. So far that appears to be the case. Why is it that America is controlled by billionaires who are in your face? They're running a 1%er for a president. And there isn't, apart from you and Barbara Ehrenreich, I don't see a lot of people standing up for the poor.
Yeah, you look at our electoral system, and 10 or 20 years ago, I would have said it really favors the very rich, and it just keeps on slanting that way. You've got Citizens United and super PACs, and the laws have loosened so much, or they've created all these opportunities for billionaires to just spend unlimited amounts of money. It used to be hard, right? You had to kind of find a guy who was willing to bundle a lot of $5,000 contributions because there were caps on that. But with super PACs, you know, some rich casino mogul in Las Vegas can talk about morality through Newt Gingrich, give him $10 million. I mean, it's really gotten absurd, and that's where that stat comes, that it's, you know, what was it, 0.0001649, whatever you just said, that they're just putting hundreds of millions, if not, you know, millions, if not tens of millions, into these super PACs. Preposterous.
And the billionaires met on Wall Street on Monday and Tuesday, hosted by multi-billionaire Pete Peterson, where they all attended what was called the Fiscal Summit. And it was an extraordinary collection of rich white guys who basically are acting like they're the adults in the room, and that the greatest problem facing the United States is the deficit, which incidentally George Bush largely ran up with unfunded wars and crashing the economy. But leaving that aside, you had Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner there, House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House John Boehner, along with former President Clinton, all being hosted by former Nixon Commerce Secretary turned hedge fund billionaire Pete Peterson. I'm sure he was paying them all handsomely to attend. And this, again, I find mind-boggling, that these wealthy white men are basically saying to America, our biggest problem is that we have this abstraction called the deficit, and that the only way we can solve this thing is, and I mean, what's really implied here is that the poor and the middle class have been just getting away with it for too long. They're living in luxury with all these wonderful benefits from Social Security and Medicare, and we simply just got to stop this profligacy. I mean, it's an amazing narrative.
You know, I'll have to confess, I went to the summit last year, and I walked away thinking, okay, he's putting the spotlight on an important issue. We do have to worry about the deficit, and you know, he's talking about an important issue. But this year, I mean, that he just came out and said the answer is austerity again, as you said it well, like as if they're the adults in the room. I mean, let's look at who's paying the fair share of taxes. Let's look who's not paying their fair share of taxes. I mean, that's the crime here. That's what I wish that the Pete Petersons of the world were coming out and saying, like Warren Buffett is saying, there are billionaires, there are rich white guys who are saying precisely the opposite. Yes, we need to get this deficit under control, but the answer is that, you know, the top tax rate right now is 35%. I mean, in the 60s, in the early 60s, it was 70% or more. We need a couple of more tax brackets, that the person who's making $250,000 a year is different than the person who's making $2.5 million a year, who's different than the person making $25 million a year. And we just need to have more brackets up there to make up this deficit. The other thing to say is, like, you know, I do agree that we need to deal with the deficit, but any economist is going to tell you, a moderate economist, some conservative economists, if they're being honest, is that you don't implement austerity during a recession, that government spending is just basic economics 101, that you need to, you can't rein in spending in a recession because you're just going to make the problem worse. I mean, that's what's happening in Europe, and it kills me that we're talking about doing the same here.
Again, I'm speaking with Gary Rivlin, journalist and author of five books, including Broke USA. He's the co-editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with Barbara Ehrenreich. And we're talking about a new study that came out today an article by Barbara Ehrenreich and also by Gary Rivlin. Barbara's Looting the Lives of the Poor. And Gary's article is America's Poverty Tax, how we're in fact taxing the poor. Now, the point that you just made, Gary, I think is at the heart of the presidential race, in the sense that this 1% of Mitt Romney is portraying himself as the adult in the room. He's the businessman, the successful businessman, and he really knows what's going on. And of course, he's calling for austerity, and he supports the Ryan budget. And this, the billionaire hedge fund, Pete Peterson, who's corralled all these people, and he's been spending a lot of money to get the word across through think tanks, etc. And it's been successful. A lot of Americans, particularly the middle class and working Americans, have bought this ridiculous idea that, you know, it's just like the household debt analogy, you know, that we have a debt that's unsustainable, and we've maxed out our credit cards, and we've just taken on too much debt. And as a family and a household, we've lived above our means, therefore we all have to tighten our belts. But in this case, only the poor and middle class have to tighten their belts. The people on Wall Street are allowed to loosen theirs and run roughshod. The need for economic literacy in this country couldn't be greater. You just pointed it out. It's economics 101. If you're in a recession, you need to stimulate and prime the pump, not turn off the tap. And we've seen what's happened when they've done that in Greece and Spain and in Britain, and they're calling for it here. And that the only way to get revenues here in the state of California, we're in a terrible shape because the revenues aren't coming in. The only way to get revenues to come in is to stimulate the economy so people have money in their pockets, they spend money, you create demand, and then very soon, once you get the whole economy up and running, you pay down the debt, which is actually what Clinton did in his era. So who's going to make these economic 101 arguments? Are they too complicated for the electorate?
I mean, I don't think so. And by the way, I'd go a little bit further. I mean, you look at the Ryan plan, which Mitt Romney has embraced, so you can call it the Romney plan as well. I mean, to the extent that they put up specifics, the deficit would widen under their plan. Yes, they would slash the safety net so they'd save money, but they want to slash income tax. I think Romney, if I'm remembering the details right, wants to lower taxes by, 10 percentage points for each bracket. So the people paying 35% would pay 25%. That's just going to destroy our federal budget, and by extension, to use the Pete Peterson argument, is just going to make life that much harder for future generations. So that's a shame. But, you know, I mean, the campaign hasn't really started. I mean, I do have faith that this isn't going to be a winning argument. I do optimistically perhaps think that Romney's embracing of the Ryan plan will hurt them. That's too radical for people. I'd like to think, and I think the polls back me up here, that the average American realizes that both things have to happen. That, yes, we need some cuts, but it's not fair. It's not fair that Mitt Romney paid 14% to taxes, and me, you, and most people out there paid 35% in taxes. People get that. And I'm convinced. And again, a lot of the billionaires, you've got Gates and Buffett, et cetera, out there talking about this problem. So, you know, maybe I'm just a bit more optimistic than you on that front.
Well, I'm basing my observations on what's happening on the Hill, what's happening with Ryan and Cantor and Boehner, and now Boehner's threatening to do another debt ceiling meltdown and hold the country hostage for another Tea Party tantrum. and that there again, that's all based upon this bizarre ideology that, I mean, you can't deny that we do have a debt, and it's now the servicing of the debt, by the way, is the third biggest item on the federal budget. But of course, the debt is owned by the rich and the poor service it through their taxes. And since the Mitt Romneys of this world don't pay anything like what they should be paying, the poor have to do a disproportionate amount of servicing of the debt since it's a compulsory payment.
So, and here's where Aaron Reich's essay, Looting the Lives of the Poor, is so brilliant, because, you know, what governments have had to turn to is like, well, let's make people pay for their own court costs. Let's make people pay for their own jail cell. Let's make people pay for petty crimes, which calls to mind that famous quote that, you know, the laws making it illegal to sleep under a bridge affect the rich and poor alike. You know, that there are all these different fees that government has come up with that disproportionately hurt the poor. And, you know, you look at it, how much money do we spend on the war of poverty? How much do we spend on TANF, the new AFDC? How much do we spend on SNAP, the new food stamps? And yet, with the other hand, take money out of people's pockets. I mean, Popper's point is like, well, at least let's stop doing harm. You know, we could talk about what programs we need to have, what's working, what's not working, but let's first stop doing no harm. Then you look at private business. You know, there's a study out that says that wage theft, you know, the employers taking from the pockets of their employees, amounts to $100 billion a year. You know, cheating the waitress and waiters out of their tips, that kind of stuff. I read about all these businesses that are soaking those living on the economic margins, those who don't have enough paycheck to last the month. They go to the payday lender, and the average payday lending customer is paying $500 or $600 in fees every year. You know, these people making $20,000, $25,000 a year trying to get by and paying these fees that work out to an interest rate of 400% a year. You look at rent to own, they charge twice, 2.5 times for the same item at the rent to own shop because people have lousy credit. They can't buy it on a credit card. And you know, they need the bedroom set for their kids, and so they buy it on time, essentially, and pay 2.5 times as much. So there's almost like a poverty tax. Check cashers. The average check cashing customer spends $900 a year at a check cashier. I mean, again, $20,000, that's like almost a 5% tax that you're paying because you messed up your relationship with the bank, you bounced too many checks, you can't have a bank account anymore, and so then you're falling prey to the corner check cashier. And so those are the kind of things we're trying to look at, like, okay, let's figure out ways we could stop harm from being done to help the poor, on top of the ways we're spending money as a government.
Well, you know, Gary Rivlin, again, co-editor with Barbara Ehrenreich of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and we're talking about not just the group of white men that met in New York City Monday and Tuesday for Pete Peterson's fiscal summit, where they are basically telling the nation that the biggest problem are the deficits, and that the poor and middle class have been getting it too good, and the only way to cut the deficit is to stop the spending on Social Security and Medicare. And this is being reflected even broader in terms of their priorities. The defense budget, you know, was a part of the sequester. It was going to be automatically cut if they couldn't make a deal. The Republicans signed on to the sequester, and now they're refusing to cut the defense budget or allow the automatic cuts to come through, insisting these cuts instead have to be taken out of food stamps, etc. So there you have it. It's just, we're not making this stuff up. They have made it incredibly clear what their priorities are. What right-wing welfare is fine, agribusiness, defense spending, unlimited amounts of money, stuff that actually helps human beings, forget about it. It's appalling.
Right, right. The list of their cuts on a deal that was already made, I mean, that's what steams me. I'm curious how this is going to play out over the coming months. There was a deal. We all saw the deal being made, and they couldn't come up with an agreement, so automatically there's supposed to be these cuts. And now the House, the Republicans, are refusing to abide by the deal. I don't know how that plays out. I mean, it seems so obvious to me that, wait a second, there was a compromise. It was a deal. It's done. And for them to just walk away, I have to think that if this ends up being a winning argument, I just don't know what to say about the media coverage. I mean, I kind of get the feeling that the mainstream media is so scared of just saying what they see with their own eyes that it's just all too subtle, that it's like competing talking points, and the anchor just shrugs, like, well, who knows, those crazy idiots in Washington, they never agree on anything.
Right.
But I really do think we just have to have more reporting on what is going on. There was a deal. We all saw it happen. The Republicans are now walking away from that deal. That's what's going on now. But instead, it's sort of like this, wow, look at this amazing fight going on, round three of, you know, the Republicans versus the Democrats.
Well, last time around, when the Tea Party zealots were blackmailing to get their way in this political tantrum, where they're willing to put at risk the full faith and credit of the United States government, which they succeeded in doing because we got downgraded as a result of their antics, it was so clear that that was a one-sided situation, that the people who were holding a gun to the nation's head were the Tea Party, yet the mainstream press, NPR, of course, get their money from the government. They're terrified of offending right-wingers. The mainstream press, all of them basically treated it in that convention of equal time. Everything's equal and opposite, black and white. There are always two sides to everything. And it totally fails to really portray exactly what happened. They are incapable of taking a stand or telling the truth. And it's really appalling. And it's going to happen again if Boehner goes ahead and has another tantrum and shuts down the government.
Right, right. Yeah, okay, so now that you've depressed me and everyone else for the day.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, though, the mechanism behind this, and maybe this is a way to focus people in on why they've got to pay more attention to what's going on and take back their government. The lobby for the payday lenders is one of the more powerful lobbies and one of the more persistent lobbies on the Hill, and it's a bipartisan disgrace, but mostly Republicans. The other lobby that's equally obnoxious is the for-profit college racket. And these are both similar in as much as they both prey on the poor. The payday lenders that you've talked about and the 400% interest, you'd think that they'd be run out of town, but instead they've got a lot of traction on Capitol Hill through their lobbyists. And the for-profit college people who prey on minority students and vets who want to get an education and saddle them with huge debt, all of which, you know, they take public money, and 90% of their funds come from the taxpayer, and they charge it back to these kids at usurious rates and indebt them for life and give them a worthless diploma, and they can't even get a job, and they never will, and they'll never be able to pay off this mountain of debt. That is the face of these bottom feeders who are entrenched in Washington. So, you know, you think that that's so flagrant, we ought to go after them.
Well, you know, I know more about the payday lobbyists and the various fringe financing lobbyists. I mean, the pawnbrokers give money. I mean, all these different businesses that charge triple-digit interest rates on loans have their lobbyists in D.C. Now, there's been legislation proposed for at least 4 years, maybe more like 6 or 7 years, that would have a national usury cap. Most states in this country have a cap on interest rates, 15%, 20%, 30% a year. And the payday lenders spending money on lobbyists went state by state by state and got an exemption from the usury caps. Oh, these are just emergency loans. Let's not make them fall prey to the these usury caps. And legislators, Dick Durbin, you know, powerful senator, number three ranking senator, I believe, among the Democrats, has legislation that would say, let's just have a national usury cap. 36% annual interest rate, that's a lot of money. That's a nice big cap. And let's make every business abide by that. But legislation gets nowhere. Again, the number three ranking Democrat in the Senate has introduced this legislation. He's behind this legislation, and it doesn't get anywhere because it's not just the Republicans. The Democrats are getting money from, you know, the various fringe financial institutions. And, you know, on top of that, you know, the banks. The banks in 2011 set a record for the most amount they've ever spent on lobbying. I mean, a typical bank at J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citi, you know, they're spending $2, $3, $4, $6 million a year on lobbyists. And guess what? Wells Fargo is now in the payday lending business. I mean, they don't charge 400, 450%, but they're still charging 200%. They're still charging like astronomical rates on their payday, their short-term loan. I don't think they use payday. You know, their short-term loan product. And so, you know, they too are there in D.C. lobbying for the freedom to charge whatever they want. Credit card companies. If you ever wondered why you pay your credit card bills to, it's typically to Nevada or South Dakota, because those are two states that have no usury cap. So what happened? Citigroup, Chase, etc., they all set up their credit card operations in those states, so there'd be no cap on what they could charge for interest rates. So I'm sitting in New York right now. I think our usury cap is 16%, but I can have a credit card that has me paying an APR of 30% a year, 40% a year, because technically this bank has their credit card operations in South Dakota, Nevada, Delaware is another place that doesn't have a usury cap.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Gary Revlin.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Revlin, who is a journalist and author of 5 books, including Broke USA. He's co-editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with Barbara Ehrenreich, and he covered Harold Washington's Chicago. Studs Terkel said of him, he was to the Chicago political scene what I.F. Stone was to the national picture. And he has an article at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project's website, America's Poverty Tax. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the U.S. Census Bureau report that whites are becoming a minority in America.